Hello. Welcome to Illinois Radio Reader. This is Lisa bringing you the News Gazette on this Wednesday, April 24th, 2024. Let's start with the local news. On the front page, we have a cheerful picture of children waving big placards that are colorful and cute and saying things like, "Way to go," and "Just keep running," because the Christie Clinic Illinois race is coming to town. With Saturday's full marathon coming to the streets of Savoy, students at the Montessori School of CU, located along the route, put their artistic skills to use to cheer on participants, holding handmade signs at the school in Savoy that they plan to wave this weekend. And from the University of Illinois by Luke Taylor, students plan protest in support of Palestinians. Three-part event today to include a walkout and a march. From Champaign, students in the group Act Now for Palestine, UIUC, are planning a three-part demonstration today, demanding that the University of Illinois divest from corporations and academic institutions that support the militarized occupation of the State of Israel. The organization's other demands include a public acknowledgement of the loss of Palestinian life by the State of Israel's genocidal occupation of Palestine, and the formation of a committee to address Palestinian, Muslim, and Arab affairs on campus. The protest's three stages include a walkout at noon to meet at the alma mater statue, followed by a march down Green Street, and then a community event near the Swanland Administration Building. "This is honestly the culmination of a lot of different issues we've encountered on campus," said group spokesperson Norman Hernandez. "We definitely incorporated many, many perspectives from different students, demographics, and groups to create a list of demands that is very direct and concise. It directly responds to injustices we face on campus, but also acknowledges the injustices that are going on worldwide, and is kind of in alignment with a lot of national action that's going on right now." The community event will still be part of the rally, but also includes activities like bracelet and kite making. Hernandez said that the idea was to provide a space where community members, not just students, could get engaged and learn more, even if they weren't interested in demonstrating alongside Act Now for Palestine. "With the climate of things going on around universities around the nation, we wanted to make sure that there was somewhere that people who may be kind of new to mobilizing or protesting felt comfortable in that space," he said. Despite that national climate and protests escalating at other universities, Act Now spokesperson Dima Karim said the group isn't concerned about having any issues at the U of I. "I think the university knows from the many events that we've held so far that we pose no safety risks or anything that will endanger anyone," Karim said. "I'm hoping that they know they don't need to be responding the way that other universities are responding during this time." U of I police spokesperson Pat Wade said the department was planning for this demonstration the way it has for others this semester, by following its demonstration response plan. "There will be a few extra officers in the area to protect rights and safety of both protesters and bystanders. This is the first classroom walkout that Act Now has organized, though it has demonstrated in other ways." Karim said the group has been dissatisfied with U of I's response so far. "When we go to the chancellor, when we go to the board of trustees, it's kind of a lot of shifting blame and saying that this is not up to us," she said, sort of trying to make it seem as though no one can do anything about these things. Act Now has a specific list of companies it wants the U of I to divest from, including Boeing, Caterpillar, and BlackRock. The group also wants the university to end student exchange programs in Israel. University spokesperson Robin Kaler said, "We care about all of our students and are focused on the things we can do here on our campus to deliver the educational experience they expected when they chose to come to Illinois." As for the protests itself, Kaler said that the university just hopes that demonstrators are respectful of people with different viewpoints and that people not involved return the same courtesy. Also on the front page, by Luke Taylor from Champaign, COSAD New Venture Challenge, winner found direction by guiding others. Pathlit gives non-experts an entry point into the world of generative AI development. This year's COSAD New Venture Challenge winner started with an idea he hoped would help his parents out, but has the potential to save businesses millions of dollars. Advay Gupta's father works at a big tech company, but his mother isn't very technical at all. "She asked me how to open Microsoft Word," Gupta said. When generative artificial intelligence started picking up steam, his dad talked about how development timelines were getting in the way of this exciting new tech and reducing company efficiency. His mom just wanted to understand how to use AI beyond playing around with ChatGPT. Pathlet founders in a picture, Advay Gupta, giving his pitch. "Since childhood, I've kind of wanted to build something that bridges non-technical and technical users," Gupta said. "That gave me an idea to make something that both helps my father and my mother." 8 months ago, Gupta started working on a personal project, experimenting with a drag-and-drop system for users to link different generative AI models together to make something that helps their companies. It's the same idea that allows a lot of small businesses to make personalized websites. Instead of needing to hire someone to code an entire website, you can just use a service which offers pre-built modular tools to combine to your liking. I showed it to someone here on campus, one of my mentors, and he really liked it. He said that I should make it a company, Gupta said. The next week, it was incorporated. So Pathlet was born, and the 20-year-old University of Illinois sophomore became a CEO. Within 40 days, the company had raised its first $500,000. Before long, it was accepted into Google, Amazon, and NVIDIA's startup programs, which provide various marketing and educational opportunities. For Gupta, it feels like something's happening right in my life for the first time after a long time. "It really felt amazing to know that something I made is something people want and is something people are willing to pay for." Gupta estimates that the company will spend $10 million between labor and technology, creating its own generative AI program, not to mention spending months working, making it work as desired, and navigating red tape. Pathlet can cost as little as $5 a month. Companies wouldn't need to hire AI experts to use it, so pre-existing tech staff or even people who aren't very technically inclined could piece together a program, he said. Gupta said that just about anyone who wants a personalized AI is in Pathlet's customer base, but they are especially interested in targeting consulting enterprises. "By going to the big consulting enterprise, we get to see firsthand exactly what industry benefits from AI," Gupta said. Today, AI is still a buzzword, where everyone is like, "AI is really cool. I want to implement it into my organization. But does it really help you? Does it really save you money?" That's where I think targeting consulting organizations help us figure out who to target next. The grand prize from the COSAD Challenge was $50,000, which Gupta plans to put toward general operational costs, but he felt that the networking opportunity was even more helpful. This also allowed Pathlet to get two physical office spaces. "We were kind of using the university library or my apartment as an office," Gupta said. "Having a co-working space will definitely help the team's morale a little." Continuing on the front page, another article by Jana Wiersema from Champaign. U.S. Postal Service, Mattis facility changes approved. It's expected to cost area 100 jobs. Many fear delivery impact. The U.S. Postal Service has announced its decision to move forward with changes to the Mattis Avenue Processing and Distribution Center, despite protests from community members, postal workers, and legislators. The decision to proceed, which is expected to result in a loss of about 100 local jobs, includes transferring mail processing outgoing operations to the South Suburban Processing and Distribution Center in Bedford Park and the Chicago South Regional Processing and Distribution Center in Forest Park. The Champaign facility is not closing and will remain open and be modernized as a local processing center, USPS officials said. A copy of the final plan can be found at about US excuse me, there's a site to go to, which is about.usps.com/what/strategic-plans/mpfr/welcome.htm. The agency estimates that the move will result in the loss of 100 craft positions at the Mattis Avenue Post Office and a gain of 80 positions at the South Suburban and Chicago South sites. There is also expected to be a loss of 4 management positions locally and a gain of 3 management positions at the Chicago area sites. However, they added that there will be no career layoffs as a result of the change. And the agency will work with unions and management associations amid the transition. The change is also expected to result in annual savings of $2.7 million to $3.5 million. This go-forward plan for the Champaign, Illinois facility will help USPS achieve the core goals of our Delivering for America plan, financial sustainability for our organization, and improved service reliability for our customers, the agency said. The announcement comes about a week after U.S. Representative Nikki Budzinski introduced a bill that would prevent the USPS from making major changes to processing and distribution centers based on regions with poor delivery rates. Critics of the agency's plan for the Mattis Avenue plant, including Budzinski, have expressed concerns about the potential impact on employees and mail delivery times, though the agency claims the change in processing will not delay local mail. USPS officials have also said that the proposed changes will not affect local newspapers that are dropped off at local delivery units. Those periodicals do not go through the same sortation system as regular letters. Newspapers destined to other areas or not pre-sorted by zip code would be processed in Chicago, then directed to the appropriate LPC and local delivery unit. Barbara Bridges, an employee at the Mattis Avenue Post Office, said that she knows of some community members that will hold a rally from noon to 2 p.m. on May the 2nd at the Illini Union to protest the changes. She added that she is not one of the organizers for the events. "We are not done fighting the consolidation," Bridges said. Let's move on to page A4 with an article in the opinion section by J. Mark Powell. Holy cow, history! This year's election is bad? Wait till you hear about the one in 1828. Brace yourself, America. 2024's Biden-Trump II, grumpier old men, is showing all the signs of being an especially ugly election. At ages 81 and 77 respectively, this will be the last election for both, meaning they have nothing left to lose. And let's face it, the two just don't like each other. Many people wonder if 2024 will be the nastiest presidential election in American history, to which the 1828 election says, "Hold my beer." While this year's contest will be anything but the enlightened, issues-oriented national debate the Founding Fathers intended our elections to be, it will have to shift into overdrive to surpass the sheer savagery of John Quincy Adams versus Andrew Jackson. The story began 200 years ago. In the 1824 election was a political prize fight between two heavyweight contenders. Adams was the son of a president and a prominent founding father to boot. A former congressman, senator, ambassador to Russia and Great Britain, and Secretary of State. To put it in modern terms, he was the establishment candidate. Then there was Jackson, a military hero, victor of the famous Battle of New Orleans during the War of 1812, plus a former congressman and senator. More than that, he was a driving figure in a new push for increased democracy in the election process. He was the insurgent candidate. House Speaker Henry Clay and Treasury Secretary William Crawford also ran, fracturing the Electoral College vote. Adams and Jackson campaigned with everything they had. Nobody won a majority of the Electoral College vote, sending the contest to the U.S. House, which elected Adams on February 9, 1825. That was a shocker to Jackson, who truly believed the House wanted him. But the real bombshell quickly followed when Adams picked Clay to be his Secretary of State. It was considered the most prestigious job in the cabinet. Jackson squealed in outrage like a scalded hog, arguing the appointment proved the election had been stolen from him. Sound familiar? Jackson called it the corrupt bargain and vowed revenge. So when 1828 rolled around, Adams and Jackson went at each other once more, this time with the ferocity of wild animals. Jackson claimed that while Adams had served in Russia, he secretly pimped for Tsar Alexander I and arranged for a young girl to be his prostitute. He also alleged that Adams not only put a pool table in the White House, shocking to the sensibilities of 1828, but he even had the government pay for it. The Adams campaign hit back just as hard. It dredged up an embarrassing incident from Jackson's marriage. Wife Rachel was married to a Kentuckian, whom historians believe was cruel at best and abusive at worst. The couple separated in 1789. Jackson fell head over heels in love when they met, and they eloped around 1791 when Rachel's divorce was finalized. Except it hadn't been finalized. Divorce was a long, drawn-out proceeding back then. The situation was made worse by primitive communication and transportation between two largely frontier areas. In Rachel's case, some of the final I's hadn't been dotted nor T's crossed when the wedding ceremony was performed, though the couple mistakenly believed the divorce was a done deal. When it was officially granted in 1794, Jackson and Rachel quietly remarried. While the whole thing was innocent enough, in a technical letter of the law sense, the Jacksons had committed adultery, and Rachel was briefly a bigamist. The Adams campaign pounced. It portrayed her as a woman of loose morals, even claiming that, as America's first lady, she would be a bad influence on the wives of the nation. There was a lot more from both camps, but you get the idea. Each side not only jumped headfirst into the mud, but they gleefully rolled around in it. When the votes were counted that November, Jackson won in a landslide. He carried 15 of 24 states, snagged 178 out of 261 electoral votes, and received 55.5% of the popular vote. Jackson had his revenge, but it came at a steep personal price. Rachel Jackson, a devoutly pious Presbyterian, was mortified by the things said about her during the campaign. She essentially turned her face to the wall and died of shame. Literally, when she passed away from a heart attack 6 weeks after the election, her husband was convinced the stress and her overwhelming feeling of utter humiliation had done her in. Andrew Jackson moved into the White House a deeply embittered widower, but he went on to become one of America's most consequential presidents. He reversed many of the policies supported by Adams and injected a strain of populism into the nation's politics that is still at work today. In the end, and at a great price, history declared Jackson the winner. And an article from Urbana by Luke Taylor entitled Earth Science, Bridge to the Last Mile, NASA and U of I team up for a farm research. The NASA Acres Consortium, which connects technology from outer space to farming here on Earth, includes dozens of partners, but its chief scientist is the University of Illinois' own Kaiyu Guan. NASA officials visited the U of I on Tuesday to discuss further partnership, especially when it comes to tackling food insecurity and agricultural challenges. Representatives from groups that work directly with farmers like Illinois Farm Bureau, Soybean Association, and Corn Growers Association also had a chance to join the conversation, which Guan was excited about. If we already have NASA data, if we have the tools, how can we actually bring that to the hands of farmers to make a real impact on the ground, he said. The last mile in science, and any work really, is getting it out into use, said NASA Acres Executive Director Alyssa Whitcraft. This type of meeting where we sit around a round table, we have these conversations, that's the beginning of actually setting up the bridge that can cross the last mile. The U of I has been part of NASA Acres since it started in March 2023. NASA is able to provide helpful data to agriculture researchers by way of highly detailed satellite, Earth Observation, which can monitor things like water tables, disease, and more. For example, one current project aims to make irrigation more efficient in states like California by monitoring soil and crop water status and providing accurate weather forecasts. When you think about NASA, you think about launching rockets and launching satellites. But one of the biggest NASA programs is Earth Science, Guan said. Wheatcraft said that NASA has been involved in agriculture since the 70s. There was a mismatch, you could say, between some of the satellite data and some of the questions that were being asked on farms, Wheatcraft said. Within the last decade, NASA has put more focus on connecting with both agriculture researchers and farmers to find data that directly helps them, eventually leading to the NASA Acres Consortium. One of the things we really like to accomplish is getting more tools that use satellite data in the hands of farmers, ranchers, and other agri-food systems. These people who are involved in food security and food production in the U.S. are the ones, Wheatcraft said. We also need satellite data to better understand what's happening, what's changing, why it's changing, whether we're seeing different things happen, whether it's a natural influence or it's a human influence, and things like that to help farmers make the best decisions that create a solid bottom line for their farms. Also in continuing on A5, an article by Dave Hinton from DeLand. Illinois Corn Marketing Board, Piatt County among stops by Japanese Agriculture Group. An 8-person contingent of media and academia from Japan studying the grain industry and ethanol in the United States paid a visit to rural DeLand Farm Tuesday morning. The stop at the Jim Reed Farm was part of a week-long visit, hosted by the Illinois Corn Marketing Board. Reed's Piatt County Farm was selected due to its status as a former chairman of the board and currently serving as a U.S. Grains Council board member. The day's rain prevented Reed and the crew from continuing their spring planting, but the visitors were able to quiz Reed on the tillage practices, herbicide use, and trips over the field, he said. There were a lot of questions about ethanol and whether you're a tillage person or a no-till person. Reed and family used several tillage practices. To combat erosion, they used no-till on sloping ground and plant cereal rye in other areas. They also use tillage in areas where it makes sense, he said. It's always a balance. Where you use less tillage, you kind of need more herbicide. Tommy Hamamoto, Japan director for the U.S. Grains Council, said the group's trip also includes stops at 3 ethanol plants, the Marquee Energy Plant in Hennepin, an Archer Daniels Midland facility in Decatur, and the Green Plains plant in Madison. The group spent part of Monday at the Illinois Corn Marketing Board offices in Bloomington, talking about corn production, trends, and the outlook for the coming year. We talked a lot about conservation and the different changes that are happening on the farm, said Colin Waters, Director of Exports and Marketing for the Corn Marketing Board. We also heard from researchers at the Argonne National Laboratory who lead the effort on greenhouse gas emissions accounting. Hamamoto said the primary objective of the trip is to let them understand that the U.S. has ample supply of corn for food, feed, and fuel, and it will continue growing in the future, so they will not need to be concerned about a shortage of corn. Japan is the third largest importer of U.S. corn in the world with 10 million metric tons per year. The importance is there to keep the Japanese customers using U.S. corn, Hamamoto said. The country uses about 200 million gallons of ethanol annually, made from corn imported from the U.S. and Brazil. Hamamoto said Japan grows virtually no corn on its own. It primarily grows rice, plus fruits and vegetables. Waters said the Japanese want to get a better understanding on what the U.S. ethanol industry is like. Over the last few years, Illinois and other states with the Grain Council have emphasized market development work in Japan, especially ethanol, Waters said. The contingent is scheduled to fly to Washington, D.C. on Wednesday, meeting with representatives from national organizations such as the Renewable Fuels and National Corn Growers Group, as well as representatives on Capitol Hill and individuals who work on biofuel policy. Let's end this half of the News Gazette with a day today in history. An area history in 1924, Professor Stuart Pratt Sherman, head of the University of Illinois English Department, handed in his resignation to become the literacy editor of the New York Herald Tribune. In 1974, the Assembly Hall maintenance staff will soon be taking a new look at the ceiling of the building, including some areas that have not been inspected since the building was constructed in 1963. And in 2009, despite outspoken opposition from local developers, the Champaign City Council voted to raise development fees by an average of 25% to 30%. The increases will take effect June 1st and will generate an additional $168,000 annually for the city. International history today. On April the 24th, 1995, the final bomb linked to the Unabomber exploded inside the Sacramento, California offices of a lobbying group for the wood products industry, killing chief lobbyist Gilbert B. Murray. Theodore Kaczynski was later sentenced to 4 lifetimes in prison for a series of bombings that killed 3 people and injured 29 others. On this date, in 1877, federal troops were ordered out of New Orleans, ending the North's post-Civil War rule in the South. And in 1915, on what's considered the start of the Armenian Genocide, the Ottoman Empire began rounding up Armenian political and cultural leaders in Constantinople. In 1960, rioting erupted in Biloxi, Mississippi, after black protesters staging a wade-in at a whites-only beach were attacked by a crowd of hostile white people. Well, we still have a little more time, so I'm going to go ahead to the Champaign Police from Champaign with one more article before the break's up. 2 held for allegedly robbing store at gunpoint by Samuel Lysak. Champaign police arrested 2 19-year-olds on Tuesday for allegedly robbing a convenience store at gunpoint in the early morning hours. Champaign police were dispatched to a business in the 1200 block of North Mattis Avenue for a report of an armed robbery at midnight on Tuesday. On scene, officers learned that 2 men had robbed the business at gunpoint before fleeing on foot. During the robbery, 1 man held the clerks at gunpoint while the 2nd man served as a lookout, police said. No one was injured in this incident, and the men took an unknown amount of cash. Police immediately initiated a canine track and canvassed the area for witnesses and video evidence. Officers located the men leaving a home in the 1400 block of Holly Hill Drive at 12:49 a.m. and conducted a traffic stop. Investigators then authored a search warrant for the house. The search warrant was served at 7:11 a.m. with assistance from CPD's SWAT team. While searching the home, investigators allegedly located evidence related to the robbery scene on Mattis. As a result, Champaign police arrested Randy C. Copeland, 19, of Chicago, and Trayvon Gibson, 19, of Hammond, Indiana, on initial charges including armed robbery and unlawful use of weapons. Police continue to canvass the surrounding area for witnesses and video footage that may be of investigative assistance. Any resident or business in the nearby area with exterior surveillance camera systems is encouraged to notify police. And now we'll take a break from the first half of the News Gazette. I'll be back in just a moment.